All right. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Tech Can't Save Us podcast by Literal Humans. We are so happy today to have Katie Budi-Adorno, founder and CEO of Lean Lab Education. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So we're going to dive into all things ed tech and supply and demand in that space and product-led innovation on today's podcast. Just to give folks a quick background, I used to be a teacher, and I know, Katie, you've got a long and storied background in the education space, which we'll dig into. But tell everyone how we got connected and, you know, how, you know, Lean Lab's work is unfurling, I would say, in the recent past here.
Yeah, man. I'll start with the second part of that question. This last year has been one for the books in so many ways, and I won't even go into all the details, but essentially it's allowed us at Lean Lab to take kind of a substantial pivot and deepen our work in a lot of ways as it relates to research and development of emerging technologies and education. But the way we got to know you, Paul, was through the work at Literal Humans and realizing as we were navigating all the complexity of 2020, as well as an organizational pivot, we needed some extra support and telling our story and communicating through all of these, communicating to our key audiences how we were changing, how we were evolving, and why, and how this crazy last year has impacted our work.
Well, it's been exciting to work with you all on, you know, like, you know, telling your story to funders and working on the annual report and just sort of refreshing the brand identity. And it's a journey. So we're excited to be partners with you all on it. So thank you for your faith in us and your partnership. So grateful. Well, let's dive in. So, you know, a lot of folks don't know what Lean Lab is and what you all do and your amazing mission. So let's just dig into that. Tell us the journey of how you founded Lean Lab and what you're up to at Lean Lab.
Yeah, the founding journey. So Lean Lab Education, what we do, our mission is to launch transformational education innovations that have national impact. And what that kind of concretely means is generally we work with education technology companies or emerging education innovations that are focusing on improving public education in K-12 space. In a nutshell, our end goal is just trying to make sure that we're helping those products improve to the end of benefiting students as best we can. But the genesis of all of that started about 8 years ago. We're based in Kansas City, Missouri, which is kind of a funny thing because most of our clients are national or international now. However, we started because I was raised by two community organizers here and I was a teacher here. So I was raised by two organizers, and that what that kind of meant for my path was I grew up with this profound sense or obligation or belief system that of the power of community, and that communities, specifically underserved communities, typically have the solutions to their own problems, and that they're oftentimes under leverage. So that was kind of the sentiment I grew up in. My mom was in housing, my dad was in healthcare, and then eventually I thought I would go into education and kind of to continue the trend of social good. And I was a Teach for America teacher, but if people are familiar with that program, but I was placed in my hometown, Kansas City, which is sometimes unusual for that program. So I came back here. I taught middle school math for 5 years. I really thought I was going to be a school leader, and I was on that pathway. I was an instructional coach and doing curriculum coaching and getting my admin degree. And somewhere along those lines, I had kind of crisis moment or a come to Jesus moment. I don't know what you call it, the moment of inspiration. And kind of just realized that if we were ever going to get really serious about achieving educational equity or making sure that all kids, regardless of their zip code, had access to amazing education opportunities, that we were going to have to start doing some things differently, that we weren't really achieving that target. So long story short, I jumped ship, and I thought the only way to get there is to innovate. We needed a safe space for educators to innovate new solutions. And I also was really kind of going back to the roots I was raised with, wanting to do so in a way that really honored community voice, create a place to innovate radical new solutions that could accelerate learning, but to do so being really inclusive of parent, student, teacher voice on that journey. So that, that's where Lean Lab came from.
That's so I'm glad you mentioned your parents, but so you mentioned one parent was doing housing community organizing and the other, what was the domain there?
Healthcare. My mom was the director of social services for the housing authority here in Kansas City. So all the public housing, she was overall social services there. And my dad ended his career in healthcare. He worked at kind of what's known as like Kansas City's first communist clinic. So it was kind of like a safety net clinic for free healthcare for all. It was kind of the founding story there.
Do you have any stories from your childhood of like going with them to community organizing events or any kind of like, just moments that really stick with you?
Oh yeah. I mean, we were at every protest. We were, when I was a kid, I remember my mom worked at this housing project called Chateau Courts for years. That was one of the most notorious public housing developments in Kansas City. And when I was a kid, you know, that's where my mom was also kind of a workaholic. She was going to grad school she was always doing getting some other degree and working. And we were always just kind of expected to tag along. So I have a lot of memories playing on the playground there with the kids in the development while she was staying late after work, studying or working, organizing tenants late at night or candlelight vigils for, I remember going to several of those with Alvin Brooks, who was a famous organizer here. Unfortunately, when the crime rate was going up in the early 90s. So yeah, tons of memories.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I relate to the story of like, you know, I did TFA as well, and I got placed in my home city. I grew up outside of Philadelphia, but got placed in Philadelphia. And and then just that journey afterwards, and then kind of, I appreciate that you use the phrase come to Jesus moment, because like with my namesake being Paul, I'm supposed to have a lot of those apparently, because, you know, he's the one who fell off his horse and sort of, you know, had that moment. So, I had a few of those as well. So, getting into education, getting out of education, getting back in through, the work we're doing now. But that story really resonates. So I appreciate you sharing it there. So one thing we like to talk about on the podcast here is just like, you know, tech for good and kind of like defining what that means. What is it? It's kind of a buzzword. Buzzwords are ripe in education space as well. So where do you see Lean Lab fitting within the broader tech for good landscape and why, I guess?
And what's funny is that we didn't start out solely focused on tech. It was broad innovation. It was bring us anything that you have an idea to improve education. That could be a nonprofit service, that could be a curriculum, that could be a program, or that could be tech. Over the years, overwhelmingly, people have been wanting to engage in tech. And I think that's just a symptom of it's 2021, especially now. And this last year in this world of distance learning. So I think for me, when I think about tech for good, I think sometimes we get pushed back in terms of, does it have to be tech, or tech is known as being so profit motivated. And really, I think it's an acknowledgement of the tools that we are given in this moment in time. Like the world has changed. We interact primarily through screens. But with that comes some responsibility and some potential. So I think if that's a foregone conclusion that we're going to be a tech immersed society, then how do we take that and use it for good, to your point? And how do we make sure that those who should be the biggest beneficiaries of this tech in the education context, parents, students, teachers, are the ones that are influencing its development, are the ones that are holding it responsible in some ways and saying this is meeting the desired outcome or it's not. And we figure out processes and systems to do that. So that's kind of rambly, that's kind of how I think about it. And the sense that I believe tech is here to stay. Now it's up to us to figure out how do we use it and leverage its full potential, because I think there's some really beautiful things we can do if we keep the integrity of what we want it to accomplish.
And how do you balance that demand? Like, it feels like you're being pulled in the direction of tech just because of the zeitgeist and everything that's going on in society, but also I'm sure there's some great low tech solutions out there that, you know, help families and schools and kids just as well. So how do you navigate that as an organization?
Yeah, I mean, so for a long time, up until distance learning started and kids like literally didn't have the luxury of having a teacher in front of a student, we really shied away of incubating or supporting any education technology that had kids on screens. Almost everything we had incubated was making teachers' lives easier or automating systems for administrators. So the idea was, how can we leverage tech to free up the humans in a school building to have more authentic and caring interactions with children? And we still, I think, are kind of innovating around the fringe of that. Now, I think with distance learning, of course, we didn't have that luxury because, you know, caregivers just couldn't be in contact with children in person. Mm-hmm. However, I think there's so much we've learned about learning science and the way humans engage with technology that, again, we could ask those questions of, hey, look, if the people are making billions of dollars of getting kids and all adults hooked on social media and gaming, how do we take that same kind of methodology and use it to accelerate learning outcomes and meet kids where they are and kind of envision a world where we could do that? So that's kind of how it's evolved a little bit. Mm-hmm.
That's a good segue into this next question about, you know, we've talked, or I've heard you talk about the mismatch between supply and demand in the ed tech space. And so, you know, there's a lot of, you know, profit-driven companies out there who are creating these things and pushing them into the education space. So I'd be curious, like, what your diagnosis is about that mismatch. And yeah, if you could just tell us more about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the education technology field in particular is really fascinating because your user is not your buyer. And, and the way venture capital flows into ed tech doesn't always match up with where there's demand always. So for instance, typically in education technology, it's really hard to, the ceiling for raising venture capital to get to a place where you're really growing like crazy has been harder and harder to come by. People, investors expect more consistent annual revenue, that, and the stakes are higher than ever before. So they're looking, it's hard to get investment if you're not already bringing in over $1 million annually. So it's just a hard threshold to cross. But it's kind of a chicken and egg scenario. How do you get the capital to grow as a company if you aren't already in market? And then how do you sustain to get to a place where you have that level of revenue if you don't have some resources to help get you there? And it's equally hard because sales cycles in education are really long. They're like you get one window a year, and if you miss it, you miss it. That being said, the contract sizes can be quite large. So if you make it, you can close $1 million in annual revenue with two contracts, but you might miss your shot for another 12 months. So it's hard to figure that out. The other complexity, again, is that like your users aren't your buyers. So obviously, so we do a lot of work at LeanLab to try to understand what parents, students, and teachers need. Mm-hmm. We know what those are. Unfortunately, those don't match up always to what administrators have line items to purchase. Mm-hmm. And then investors are taking their cues from what administrators have line items to purchase. So you might have this disconnect. A good example of that is social emotional learning. Mm-hmm. We've heard in the field from parents, students, teachers saying, hey, especially this last year, look, like this has been an emotionally really hard time for teachers and students. We need tools that can help better diagnose students' social emotional states and prescribe interventions that are research-based or help those interventions be lower touch so that all students have a better sense of well-being, right? Which is like a beautiful thing that I believe we all want children to feel okay. That's like something we can all norm on. Right. However, the complexity, and there's been such a growing field of research around like what that means, what social emotional learning actually means. And it's been standardized, and people like Angela Duckworth give great keynotes and write brilliant books about what this body of work looks like and what non-academic traits need to look like for kids to have a better sense of well-being emotionally. So this body of work exists. There's been kind of consensus that it's important. However, there's not necessarily the funding mechanism to support that. So we've done a lot of work of like incubating some social emotional learning solutions. We're studying two right now, and they're fabulous. They're doing good things. But the challenge is there's not federal or state line items that directly go to support that. So school administrators then are saying, I really want to support this program, but I'm having to maneuver my budget and figure out where it fits. And there's not a natural bucket. I can't just say, oh, this is a no-brainer. This is curriculum support or an academic intervention that I already have a line item for that I'm already getting federal money for that I can just expense. So they're kind of hodgepodging it together. That said, they're willing to do that, which indicates typically that there's an emerging market there. Mm-hmm. But the question is, because the way public education budget works, will the government subsidies like shift to support that emerging demand? And that's a big unknown. So what you see happening now is that investors will say, I'll support social emotional learning contingent upon if it's embedded into a pre-existing line item, meaning you can take a math curriculum and layer some social emotional supports over it. And I'd feel more comfortable with that because it would, there's a line item to support it. So it gets very complex pretty quickly, but long story short, it's like the people with buying power don't necessarily know what the needs are of the people in the classroom, the end users. The people with capital power, like venture capitalists, are going off the cues of what's going to be the shortest sales cycle. So it's, you kind of have a mismatch on multiple layers.
And have you seen any, is Lean Lab, or have you seen any other work being done to sort of correct that mismatch at the sort of buyer investor stage or the line item stage that you mentioned?
I mean, to correct, there's so like in ed tech circles, there's like a very small niche community that cares about ed tech procurement, education procurement, but it's like it's not like the sexiest thing in the world. There is like a weird little like plan that gets together a couple times a year and are like, hey, this is what we learned about procurement cycles and this is an evidence-based procurement. But there isn't a lot of conversation around like why there's a mismatch between capital. And part of it's because it's just complex. It's policy. It involves policy. So if you really want to make a change like social emotional learning, that requires policy intervention, that's just really cumbersome. I think there could be hope with the new Biden administration, but that's just a long journey to take to ensure that this could become a huge emerging scale market that is really investable. So, but that being said, I mean, I think what you're trying to get at is like, is it worth it? Who does that work? What do we do in instead? Or we just say, throw up our hands and say, oh, we'll just keep doing what we can with what exists.
The community voice thing that, you know, obviously that's like a major priority for Lean Lab Education. Like that seems to be the missing piece at the district level, like in terms of, okay, I'm this district that, you know, this district or school administrator, I'm going to put in this line item, but that is somewhat divorced from what the community is telling me it needs or school, you know, or classrooms are telling me what they need. So like, what role do you see community voice and co-design playing in ed tech innovation, like moving forward and in potentially solving for that problem or just creating better, you know, a better match for what the needs are out there?
Yeah. I mean, so our good segue, our solve for that is like, we're not going to become like knowing this mismatch exists. I think we had to think internally, like what's the shortest path then to create change, knowing that these are just the environmental constraints that we have. One is like we could pivot and become like a policy think tank and say, what are the top like funding conditions that need to be true to facilitate some of these things getting into market. However, we didn't want to go that route. So where we kind of doubled down is what we were already good at, which was the innovation work and research and development, and saying, okay, what are the interventions we can put in place and when a product is still developing to make sure that they are, one, responsive to community needs, two, they're entering into a market that could be fundable, that does have some support, or three, if we're not entering into a market that currently has like isn't investable, do we believe that it's a big enough opportunity that the tides could change over time? Meaning, like, are we willing to take this bet? Social emotional learning is one of those, actually. Like, we're willing to continue to incubate the solutions because we think it's a big enough problem that we think eventually, if we can demonstrate that this is moving the needle for children, people will get on board and the policy winds will shift. So that's kind of how we think about it. But with the co-design process, what that means and what we do is we essentially say, hey, you're starting a new innovation. You think it solves a problem. Let's actually test that by putting it in the actual real environment where that problem you think exists. And then let's invite those people that you think have that problem to the table to help guide you and steer you and say, this is right or this is not right. So what that looks like is taking, again, like a social emotional learning tool, putting it in a classroom where you have children, teachers, counselors, and literally bringing them to the table and saying, what does this need to look like? How does this need to improve? And how do we measure that improvement? How do we hold this tool accountable and see if it's working or not? That's kind of our hope. And our hope is if we do that early enough in a product cycle, that by the time it gets venture capital and begins scaling, that it's truly the right solution for the problem.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to throw you a softball here. Do you want to shout out those two social emotional tools that you're testing right now? Are you able to reveal those?
Give them some love. Yeah, sure. One is Classcraft, which is a Canadian, it's a tool based in Quebec, but they've worked a lot in the United States, and it's kind of based off of World of Warcraft. I'm this targeting student, kind of trying to augment student intrinsic motivation. And then the other one is called Zone to Grow, which helps students identify their own social emotional states and helps kind of communicate that information back to teachers and administrators so they can better target students that might need some more love.
Nice. That's what podcasts are all about, product placement. So glad we could shout those out. And it's cool that LeanLab's got an international presence now too. I mean, I gather Australia, Canada, a few other places.
Yeah. What we've learned is the United States, everyone, you know, I get it. It's the United States. So internationally, people want to grow here, especially if they're in tech and innovation. But in education, it's a really nuanced space. I don't think people underestimate when they're like, I want to get into market in the United States. They don't realize we don't have a national curriculum. That means we're... We don't have national standards. Instead, we have 51, or actually 52, if you count DC and Puerto Rico, like sets of standards and procurement cycles and all of that. So it's, you know, it's a lot.
Not to mention, what are there, like 15,000 districts or something like that in the United States, somewhere around that number? All the different, you know, variations of, you know, and the, you know, there is a lot of, what I'm going to go back to my ed school background, institutional isomorphism. It's one of those like ed school terms, but basically the idea is like, it's like sort of marveling at the idea that like, oh, you know, we love to lean into the idea that all the districts are so different and kids in like Alaska are learning so differently from kids in Australia. But like ultimately, and even when you look at charters and stuff, like the districts end up looking pretty much the same. So it's like that concept is exploring why that's the case and exploring the sort of the lore around, you know, like these labs of democracy, but ultimately sort of landing in this slightly cynical point of like, they're kind of pretty similar. And like, why is that? And what implications does that have for learning and families and stuff? So yeah, super, super ed school classroom stuff there.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just like American individualism. Like we think we're all like really unique flowers and that will manifest in all these very hyper-localized governance solutions. And really they just end up being, you're like kind of different modular versions of the same thing, which is okay.
It's all right. But I mean, that's another interesting segue into, you know, a question about product-led innovation, because when things are so, okay, like assume for a second that they are very similar, but they are diffuse, you know, like there's 15,000 of them and they operate somewhat differently, but somewhat the same or largely the same. You know, what does product-led innovation look like when you're looking at a market like that in ed tech? And I guess, how have you seen it done effectively if you're leading from the product side, I guess?
Yeah, I think I would back up and say name that product-led innovation is kind of jargony in itself. So like maybe what we're talking about, what it's not first. So like one indictment that we have in the education system is that like it's so slow to change, right? That class people probably have seen the memes of like classrooms today look identical to what they looked like 100 years ago. Kids are still sitting in rows, one size fits all curriculum, blah, blah, blah. But one, we don't really talk about why that is. And one reason I think that is because still, yes, we have this isomorphic, am I using that word right? Isomorphism. Yeah. That's across the United States, meaning that we have a ton of tiny, you know, about 13,000 to 15,000 different districts and decision makers, but that decision making still happens by and large top down. So it's typically the way it's happened is a superintendent and their board of directors and maybe a procurement director who's kind of taking orders and maybe a couple chief will sit down and say, hey, this is what's up for bid this year. We want a new reading curriculum and we want new AstroTurf and we want new lockers, and this is what we have line item, and we're going to sign a 5-year contract for that, and then the rest are just on auto renew. And that's the way, and that's kind of, if you kind of peel back, that's kind of the way change happens in education, which kind of think illuminates like why it's so hard, because it's like, oh, this is very bureaucratic thing. So then you have to think about how do you disrupt that. And I think what's exciting about product-led innovation is that especially this last, it's been happening these last few years, but these last couple of years is the way, one way to disrupt our you know, intervene in that kind of system is to say, well, then if everything is typically coming from the top down, how do we change the way teachers are behaving in their classroom with tech right away? Mm-hmm. And so one way to do that is to design really teacher-friendly tools that are very intuitive, that are no-brainers, that are, hey, this solves an immediate problem in my classroom. I'm going to start adopting this rather than waiting for that really cumbersome top-down procurement cycle to, you know, take for it to take 2 years for the smart board to show up in my classroom as one example of like top-down tech that's happening in classrooms. And what's exciting about like the evolution of tech is that I think we're seeing that happen faster and more elegant than ever before. So, you know, Class Dojo is a good example of this. Like I was a middle school teacher. So like classroom management is a huge thing. And if you could just have a tool to gamify student engagement and say, hey, this is how many, you know, positive points you have for good behavior. And I can visualize that right away. And if the whole class can see it, and if I'm having an issue, I can use a digital product to note that and shoots a notification off to your parent. That's a huge win. And you see these products have come into the market and they've also gone on a freemium model. So it's, I can also use this product as a teacher for free. Mm. And then these companies are using that at classroom level adoption then to justify eventually a district sale to move bottom up and say, this product delighted so many teachers. Don't you want to keep them happy? Now let's take this up the chain instead of going the opposite, taking the opposite approach. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where product-led innovation has come from. I gave one example, but I think there are a lot. I think any tool that's really focusing on delighting its end user and making it so easy to use is a really exciting win. Like how do you get, hopefully with one company soon that really, really gets this, that their whole thesis is like, how do I hook teachers within 120 seconds? Like just make it so intuitive, so obvious that they want to adopt it. They're already using it. And so that's just like a good example of product, again, product-led innovation. It's something so easy to use, so obviously solving the problem.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that it assumes that like in the product development, like a lot of, you know, community voice and like, you know, research and sort of iteration on the product, like that's assumed on the front end in terms of really good product-led innovation?
I mean, I think it takes a couple ingredients. I think one, typically you have a founder that either has that lived experience with the problem itself or is really close to it. So another good company that's a good example of this is Pear Deck, which was founded by teachers in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially a tool that allows students to engage with like a Google Slides deck. So if a teacher's making a PowerPoint presentation, kids can like chat back to the teacher and say like, hey, I don't understand this, or open the conversation. But one key ingredient there is you had founders that innately knew the problem they were trying to solve. They were like, hey, I need a way to make digital presentations actually really engaging for students, and a way to create bilateral communication. And then two, you have founders that really understand product and development and user experience and understand. I think another mismatch that's happened, especially over the last couple of years, is that you have now so much high quality consumer grade technology. So people are used to the user experience of Uber, Postmates on their phone, which is a pretty advanced user experience, that when they take that and they translate to the education setting, a lot of edtech hasn't kept up. So now you're in a clunky software and you're going, and then they're just disengaging because they don't have the attention span, or they're saying, I'm used to this other kind of interface. So I think we're seeing more founders get that intuitively and saying, I really need to invest in the product so that the user journey for something that quite frankly is much more important than if like your Subway sandwich gets to your house on time. So yeah, but it's like, we haven't invested that same level of focus and edtech products.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the food delivery thing, because I just saw that Deliveroo here in London, which is like the local delivery, food delivery service, like they're going to have their biggest valuation ever. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I'm responsible for a solid slice of that valuation, like at least maybe like 0.1% or something like that, just because how often I use them. But yeah, to your point, it's like, it's such an easy, it's like green, it's like very inviting, like the pictures of the food look so good. It's just so easy to go on and order there. But it's, I think you raise a really good point of like, yeah, we've taken consumer tech like so far in terms of like delivering delight, use the word delight, which I love, delight and like value, you know, for the consumer. And like, why haven't we done that in the context of education? I'm sure there's tons of reasons and such, but yeah, like how do we push that agenda forward? Are you seeing more like current educators, former educators jumping into that role of ed tech founder? Because you mentioned, you know, having that on the ground experience, and what's your sort of outlook on that side of things?
Yes and no. I honestly think like there was a lot more startup. I was seeing a lot more people jump ship and start startups actually a few years ago, but I think that's when a lot of things have changed. But quite honestly, like there's not as much, especially in the Midwest, like seed capital and programs to support early stage founders once past their like first couple of checks. So it's easy. You can get a couple of grants for like $10,000, $20,000 to try to get a minimum viable product off the ground. What you can't seem to get access to is once you've done that, what's the bridge capital necessary to actually justify quitting your job, cashing in your 401k, giving up all the securities to cross that chasm.
Is that unique to the Midwest, would you say, or broadly?
I think that's kind of happened broadly. I think we feel a little bit more here just because we tend to be more risk averse in general. So we never really had a huge wild, wild west, you know, tech founder ecosystem to begin with. But I've noticed it's gotten noticeably harder. And like, I think my own story, like I was a founder that left the classroom. I didn't start a for-profit company though, but it was those first 4 years were brutal in terms of they're just what, it wasn't that we weren't necessarily accessing capital. Just like there weren't capital opportunities for the type of things we were doing. Like no one was investing in education innovation. So, so that was, and it continues to be challenging. But that said, like most of the founders we work with are former educators that typically have gone off and gone into the private sector, have had another experience where they've gotten some technical expertise and now are coming back and saying, okay, I want to put these things together.
That's super interesting. It makes me think about like Lean Lab Education's positioning. Like what's that like explaining that to different audiences, like funders in particular, like sort of where you sit, like sort of between school partners and entrepreneurs and sort of, I don't know, just telling that story and convincing them of your value. It seems like a difficult, but like once they get it, it's like, oh yeah, that makes total sense. We need that. Like, how has that been for you?
It's kind of better because we've changed a lot as an organization over time. So I think part of it is like bringing people on for that journey and and I think you're right. Once they understand why we've shifted where we are, it's like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. And from where that was we actually started out as an incubator with early, really early stage concepts. We were the place that was giving those first $10,000 and $25,000 checks. But what we found was exactly what I said, was that then the people were hitting a cliff and we didn't have the capital. We weren't able to raise the capital to say, here's your next 100, 200, 500K check. We couldn't sustain that. So then we had to say, we have to move a little bit later on and say, let's find the people that have made that leap, are early in market, but still need that injection of community voice to stay true to the integrity of the product. So, or the intention of the product. So that's kind of where we shifted. But I think it's initially, I think, you know, out of like goodness of my heart, like we really did want to try to be that full spectrum. But then I think you learn how hard that is and how you have to focus in one area to get really, really good at something. And also just be honest with the conditions in which you're operating it. So that's kind of where we ended up. But I think, I mean, we're blessed to have really a wonderful funder community. Most of our funders today have been with us in some way, shape or form on this entire journey. You know, we've just, I think, built strong relationships and keep trying to, they know we're always changing too. I think now it's almost kind of like a running joke of like, what's the next thing you're doing? Because we know it's going to be different. They're invested. And I think it's the North Star doesn't change. It's the path in which we're getting there. So, and I think we're getting better. It's just you learn and you change and you grow. And that's,
Yeah. And if the last year taught us anything, like there's the time to be nimble and adaptable is now. So that's, but I think as an organization, there's like a way to do that that can feel, you know, like a little bit shaky for your investors and funders and stuff like that, but also smart as well. You know what I mean? In terms of like, hey, this is the right pivot, you know, at this particular point. So it sounds like you've fallen much more on the latter side there, obviously. So
we've tried, but it's not always pretty, you know, or easy.
One question I have for you is, and this is one role I've never occupied in the education space, but like the role of funder, like how has that felt for you to like put on that hat and embrace that role? Like that seemed to me that I'm like, oh, that's scary. You know, like what's that like?
Well, again, like I said, we were never funding. We've never been able to fund like huge amounts. But one concrete example of that was this last year, we had an opportunity to, after George Floyd and the protests here in the States and kind of the, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement really emerging this summer or re-emerging this summer, we had an opportunity to say, where do we want to participate and, or how do we want to participate in this moment in time? And one way we were fortunate to have a funder, and one area I was really passionate about, was providing entrepreneur support, because firsthand I had experience, like I didn't take a salary for 2.5 years, but there wasn't capital available when I started Lean Lab. It became also a running joke amongst funders that they would see me as a hostess or at a restaurant they were going to a meeting at night, and I would have pitched to them earlier that day, right? Because wow. I was just had to hustle that hard. And Kansas City is a small city, so you have a lot of interactions. But you know, I just kind of held that close to my heart. So this summer when that was happening, we had a funder that was willing to work with us. And I had the idea of how could we reallocate some of our current grant, given that so much has changed over this year. We're not spending as much as we thought we were going to spend in-person convenings and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Can we take that money and redirect it to micro grants to founders of color? And they were willing to do so. So that was one example. And they were small grants. They were like, I think the biggest one was like $2,500 or $3,000. Mm-hmm. But the intention was like, how do we give unrestricted money just back in the pockets of people that are doing this hustle? Because I knew, and when I was in that place, a $2,500 unrestricted grant would have been 4 months of rent, right? Mm-hmm. And that was like what I needed to not have to stay at the restaurant till midnight every night and then be up the next morning hustling the next day. Like it was just that visceral. So that was one way we were trying to think about it. But I think, I mean, in terms of giving capital, I just try to think of it very practically from that standpoint, like what's actually helpful to get people to that, meet people where they're at and get them what they need so they can keep going.
And especially at a time, like, first of all, kudos to you for that founder journey of like, you know, hustling, working part-time jobs, like get the organization started. I can absolutely relate to it in terms of just like paying myself nothing at all or less, you know, as we're launching a new agency and stuff like that. And like, it's just, it's rough, you know, and it's like not, it's, yeah, there are points when you're like, what am I doing? How am I going to make this work? And it's just, yeah, I can really relate to that. So kudos. And then also kudos for like getting money into people's pockets as quickly as possible during a pandemic. Like that's just such a smart, caring, empathetic pivot, you know, that is in line with your organizational mission. So yeah, really respect that. It's amazing. So we're going to pivot a little hard here and go to like our lightning round of sorts and talk about the sort of questions we ask every guest here. And it really is about like digging into, you know, just like your perspectives, your opinion, and giving people a flavor of, you know, how you run your organization and why, and just all things you. So being that we are a Tech for Good podcast, we like to start asking people about, you know, problems and tech solving them for us. What do you think is one big problem that tech can't solve for us?
I think just human interaction and like empathy and compassion and the power of that. I think so. Like we keep doing a lot with social emotional learning. I keep going back to that. But at the end of the day, we're just trying to find how can technology enable us to have like the right authentic human interaction, right? And what's that cue that gets us there? And I don't think you ever can replace that or those moments in the classroom, nor do I want to. So I think it's how do we free ourselves up so that we can actually be our best selves when we are with each other, with people that matter to us.
I guess you personally like seen or practice any, I don't know, interesting like sort of replacements or changes to like how you interact, like specifically during the lockdowns, during the pandemic, or seen maybe educators doing that, like kind of trying to figure out ways to replace human action or just creative ways to, you know, work around the fact that they can't see their students or work with their students, anything along those lines?
I mean, yeah, this year has been so hard for that, but I think I think people just finding ways to be more real about where they're at. So like, hey, there seems to be Zoom fatigue. Let's not force the next happy hour. Maybe we can find a walk in the park or with teachers, I think what I've seen a lot, which is really interesting, like with my 5-year-old nephew, is like teachers coming around and understanding like what one, the attention, what's a reasonable attention span or behavior for a 5-year-old that's on a screen in a living room somewhere, somewhere, and seeing them, you know, let go a little bit and like give a little more autonomy to children and say, okay, it looks like you need 5 minutes to just calm down and then come back when you're ready. And so I think people are just becoming a lot more forgiving and understanding of that this has been really hard and we need to be a little more forgiving and compassionate and understanding of just where people are at. And then find ways that interact that make sense given the situation.
Yeah, that's powerful. And it's made me as like a former teacher really just so much more grateful, you know, like, well, one, I mean, selfishly, like that I got out when I did, you know, like watching teachers like deal with this. I'm just like, y'all are true superheroes. Like this isn't like, I could never have imagined switching from the teaching that I knew to what's happening right now. And it's just like, wow, you know, and just seeing different friends of mine who are still teachers or principals even like just change their practice. And some of them are kind of like throwing their hands up. They're like, this, I didn't sign up for this, you know, like this is not, you know, and that's like very painful to watch, you know, but,
Oh yeah. But I think it also, I mean, I've heard both sides. I've heard like, it could also be really freeing too. And I think the big question mark is like, people don't want to go back to the way things were. Cause it makes you really question if it's like, if I can teach a bunch of 5-year-olds virtually and they have more autonomy, they have more bodily autonomy, I don't have to police them as they go to the bathroom. Why are we doing that in a regular context? Like, what does a world look like where we can be more adaptive and more, I don't know, actually meet kids where they're at? So I'm hoping that that's what we move toward. I don't think it's going to be easy. I think a lot of people are rightfully burnt out and questioning what's going to happen next.
No, it's really good to hear though, that, cause I don't think I've heard that side of the story of like teachers sort of come, like, you know, coming out of the other end of it and saying, okay, you know, we need to like rethink. Like, I think you tend to hear in the media when you're not as connected to K-12 education, like everything's a mess. Teachers are burned out. They hate this, you know, like, but it sounds like there's, you know, positives obviously. So.
But that's the easier story to tell. And it's a very 2020 story to tell, to rely on like, this is chaos and terrible. But I think there's, as we get to the other side, like, What can we find here that can really push the system in a positive way?
All right, moving us forward here. Tech for bad, the flip side of tech for good. What's the evilest tech application you've seen out there as someone immersed in the ed tech community? Doesn't have to be ed tech though.
I think I'm blessed. I don't think I could work in much more like consumer driven tech because like 99.9% of the ed tech founders I work with are like truly mission driven. Like no one is out there trying to just make money off of kids or anything like that. But I think in like the consumer area, we should probably be a little more concerned about privacy as consumers than we are generally. I think there's some longstanding precedents we're kind of setting up now that could be problematic down the road.
What do you think that, like, what do you, digital literacy for like kids these days, like how, like, do you think they'll be better positioned to kind of deal with that stuff or even like, you know, try to prevent, you know, the rise of bad tech in the future because they're like immersed in it? Like, what's your sort of prediction there based on, you know, the way kids are interacting with technology and education right now?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, I think it's going to continue to be more and more complex, and it's like not lost on me that we have a generation of kids that this is all they've known. They've lived their lives online, and I think there are all sorts of like ethical ramifications of that. You know, you see people being losing their jobs for tweets they tweeted when they were adolescents, things like that. So I think, you know, there just has to be a mindfulness we teach children of like everything you put out there is out there in perpetuity as far as we know. So I think we're going to have to reckon with that at some point. But I also think like they just don't, I think we haven't really talked about as a society how much we're willing to give up for consumer or for convenience culture. And I think that's something like from a privacy perspective that we'll also kind of eventually have to grapple with, or hopefully those, all of that doesn't get compromised, but we've given up a lot. So I don't know.
The privacy one is such an interesting one too, because I feel like it's such a like tree fallen in the woods and people not really realizing it sort of situation where like, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize like the degree to which they've given up so much privacy, or if you watch something like The Social Dilemma, like it's just like you're clicking a button, and like behind that click is like just so much of your rights, quote unquote, you know. So
and then the reality is, like, more times than not, it's used to like sell more ads to perpetuate. It's more profit driven than it is like someone spying on you. But the fact that that precedent is there, we just don't know how that could be used. And I think that's kind of the unnerving part.
This question I'm very excited to ask you because of your unique role, like kind of incubating, you know, products. Like, I'm just curious about if you could yourself develop a new tech product, you know, what would it be and what problem would it solve and for whom?
I always have like a running list of things that haven't happened in education that I wish would happen. So there's a few of those, but those are kind of nerdy. I like made, you know, one of our board members quit his job and join our incubator to start like a bus tracking app. Not made, he willingly joined, but that's something we've been working on for a while, like trying to use technology to solve school transportation. There's that stuff. There's also stuff like in emerging markets, like I'm really interested in like kind of decentralization and like taking cues from the crypto community and how that could impact like decentralized education systems of the future. That's another total nerdy tangent, but I think there's like something really interesting that's beginning to happen, and people are beginning to take a lot of matters into their own hand and be more skeptical of centralization in so many of its forms. And I think education could be one area we see that happen too. So
I think that's a huge one, the decentralization one. Like, that's a whole other podcast, but like, I think you're already seeing it happen with like, you know, like kids going to YouTube to learn things, and like just the freelancer hustle economy and like all that stuff. And like, you know, it's already started. I don't know. And like, I'm always questioning, like, how do school systems, however we define them, keeping up with that? Like, how could they possibly, you know what I mean? And it seems overwhelming. I don't
think they even really are aware that it's happening. And it, we are not even able to capture that data. Like, anecdotally, we know parents are been frustrated, are doing more on their own. There are more tools out there, but I think, I'd really be curious to see how that turns out.
One thing we talk about a lot too is in this tech for good conversation is balancing a life, you know, of sort of profit and purpose. So we all need to make money and provide for ourselves. You mentioned being a certain, you know, the host before as you were founding Lean Lab at a restaurant. But yeah, like, what's worked for you in terms of, you know, balancing profit and purpose in your tech for good life?
I'm not good at it. So we're a nonprofit, but we're moving towards sustainability. And I mean, I truly feel like you can do well by doing good. And maybe I put too many eggs in that basket. But like, I really believe if you're providing value, you are doing good work, you are relentless in your focus and making sure that it is sustainable, you are, you know, running a business, that it will come back to you. But that's my approach. So I don't know, that's where I kind of try to keep my eye on the prize in that way.
Yeah. It's a nice like connective tissue that I think we've had like with pretty much all guests that we have on the podcast, is like, they're, you know, they're just like really struggling with that question, and they're finding very niche and specific ways to do it. And so I think the fact that you've gotten your organization to, you know, on the path of sustainability, and you're incubating, you know, dozens, hundreds yet, I don't know, of entrepreneurs, like, you know, it's just, it's really remarkable. It's really impressive. So yeah, thank you for sharing your story with us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you bet. Where can folks find Lean Lab Education? Tell us where to go. Send us the links.
LeanLabEducation.org is our website. And then we are Lean Lab, LeanLab, Ed, short for education, on Twitter, Instagram, all that good stuff.
Nice. And we'll drop those links into the episode description there as well. So, Katie, it's been an awesome conversation. We're so grateful for the work that you do at Lean Lab. And yeah, just loved having you on and talking about nerding out on all things ed tech. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Have a good week.
All right. You too.